The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today I'll be reading to you from three different issues, all archived. One is dated December 30, 2024. All of them, of course, own the same cover design with the red border, the white inner border, Time in large block letters, and then some kind of image or portrait on the cover. And the one from December 30 is Person of the Year, Donald Trump, now again President Donald Trump. And he's seated in a blue suit, white shirt, and red tie. Basically, I'm finishing this particular magazine with the following articles: books by Annabelle Guterman, albums by Stephen Kearse, and podcasts by Eliana Docterman. If you've been listening previously, you may recall that this particular issue of Time, the December 30, 2024 issue, which is our latest here in the studio, was comprised of lists, the best whatever, based upon Time's criteria for 2024. So beginning with books by Annabelle Guterman, this is nonfiction, and there will be 10 of these. One, The Barn. In 1955, two white men were charged with the murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till, T-I-L-L, a black boy in Mississippi. In his revelatory book, Wright Thompson digs through the details of a whitewashed history, homing in on the barn where the murder took place. The barn combines Thompson's years of research with his own personal connection to the American South. Number two, F-I, two letters. I'll say it's Phi. I don't know if it's supposed to be Phi or F-I. The summer before her 50th birthday, Alexandra Fuller suffered the unimaginable. Her 21-year-old son, Phi, died in his sleep. The seemingly random nature of this tragedy, Phi was young and mostly healthy, rocked Fuller to her core. In lush prose, the author reflects on how she showed up for her surviving daughters and navigated their shared heartbreak together. Number three, Soldiers and Kings. A riveting work of narrative nonfiction, Jason De Leon's book provides a window into the world of smugglers, known as coyotes, who guide Central American migrants across the border to the U.S. For 7 years, De Leon followed smugglers and migrants as they journeyed through Mexico. With an unwavering hand, the author describes their plight and their humanity. Number four, The Lucky Ones. As a teenager in 2002, Zahra Chowdhury was living, I'll spell that, C-H-O-W-D-H-A-R-Y, was living in India when a train fire in Godhra killed dozens of Hindu pilgrims. For the 3 months that followed, the 16-year-old and her family, along with thousands of other Muslims, lived in fear as sectarian violence broke out and transformed the country. The Lucky Ones recounts this time in all its atrocities, underlying how the promise of democracy fails to account for those who need it most. Number five, The Light Eaters. Journalist Zoe Schlanger reminds us of a common truth we tend to take for granted. Plants are remarkable. Behind each stage of development in their lives is a complex system, one that she describes in awe-inspiring detail. Combining research with her own personal stories, the author illuminates why plants are so vital to our ecosystem and asks pressing questions about the relationship between humans and natural life. 6. Whiskey, W-H-I-S-K-E-Y, tender. What does it mean to really belong? It is the question at the center of Deborah Jackson Taffa's stirring memoir, which explores the author's relationship with her mixed tribe native identity. She tells stories of survival, from how her grandparents endured Indian boarding schools to her own tumultuous coming of age, living on and off a reservation. Knife, K-N-I-F-E. When Salman Rushdie was attacked on stage in Chautauqua, New York, in 2022 by a man with a knife, he felt the inevitability of a moment he'd feared, thanks to a fatwa issued by Iran's Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini over his 1988 book, The Satanic Verses. With great honesty and in gripping detail, Rushdie recounts that terrifying day and his journey to recovery. 8. There's always this year. Structured like quarters in a basketball game, Hanif Abdurraqib, H-A-B-D-U-R-R-A-Q-U-I-B, There's Always This Year, that's the title, centers on his love for the sport and what it means to go home after achieving success. He describes growing up in 1990s Columbus, just as fellow Ohioan LeBron James was coming up. In lyrical prose, he circles in on James's performance on the court, questioning why some black men are deemed exceptional and what happens to those who aren't. 9. Grief is for people. In 2019, twin crises hit Sloan Crossley back-to-back. First, her apartment was burglarized and many of her prized possessions stolen. Then, just a month later, her mentor and close friend died by suicide. These losses lie at the center of the author's unsparing memoir, which dissects this period and its aftermath. Number 10, The Friday Afternoon Club. In his memoir, actor and producer Griffin Dunn offers an inside look at his privileged life in a world where he was friends with Carrie Fisher, worked with Martin Scorsese, and hung out with his aunt, Joan Didion. But for all the glamour that fills the Friday Afternoon Club, there is a tragedy that anchors it. In 1982, the author's sister, Dominique, was strangled. Dunn unspools a compassionate portrait of his fractured family. Turning the page now to albums by Stephen Kearse, another review of 10 items, as chosen by Time. 1. Lives Outgrown, Beth Gibbons. Singer Beth Gibbons has not released much music in the 30 years since her iconic band Portishead stormed out the gate with seminal trip-hop record Dummy. Nor has she spoken to the press much, gaining a reputation for intense privacy. But she's not necessarily the hermit these habits suggest. Her second solo album, a collection of Baroque chamber folk, explores mortality with striking verve. It's a deeply interior record, abuzz with images and thoughts that feel born of rumination and experience. The bustling arrangements, which frequently feature layers of strings, percussion, woodwinds, surge and swell, as Gibbons sings of her aging body and home life, where the languid rhythms of trip-hop soundtrack, the feeling of eternal night, that blissful post-club chill, this record inhabits the charged peace of knowing that all nights and days must end. Number 2, Tiger's Blood, Waxahachie. After four albums of gauzy indie rock, Alabama-born singer Katie Crutchfield turned to folk and country for St. Cloud, her fifth record. The change of pace rooted in both a sense of homecoming and her recent embrace of sobriety recalibrated her songwriting and widened her audience. She further refines those heartland sounds on Tiger's Blood. A stunning set of easygoing down-home tunes cataloging the travails and charms of mid-30s living. The rhythm section, helmed by multi-instrumentalist Brad Cook, works wonders, flickering and flaring in tandem with Crutchfield's mighty but nimble voice. Oh, when that siren blows, rings out all over town, she sings on the title track. Indeed. 3. I Lay Down My Life for You, JPEG Mafia. Producer and rapper JPEG Mafia makes hyperactive sounds that jitter and rumble like an overloaded washing machine. Beat switches are common, samples get sourced from anywhere, and the rapping is variously smooth, abrasive, and stoned. He slows down a bit on his fifth album, which finds him processing the recoil of working with his controversial idol, Ye, FKA Kanye West, on the album Vultures 1. The songs are muscular and syncretic as ever, but the normally peevish rapper does not maintain his trolling energy for the full record, settling into a questioning and pensive pace. This in turn opens up the music, changing it from a bludgeon to a balm. JPEG does not reconcile these two modes, but with repeat listens, they feel less polar facets of a single mind. 4. What Now, Brittany Howard? There is no question mark in the title of Brittany Howard's second solo album since going on hiatus from the Alabama Shakes in 2018. The multi-instrumentalist and singer sets out to make a statement with this swinging set of funk, pop, soul, and rock tracks. Leaving behind the intimate storytelling of her debut, she lets the music take charge, showcasing her skill as an arranger with richly layered rhythms and melodies. The music never feels overstuffed, though. Its profusion in service of the searching writing, which often examines the fragility of love. Don't dare ask her what next. Number 5, Brat, Charlie XCX. What if a pop record were constructed like a MySpace page? That's the simple but genius premise of Charlie XCX's Brat, a kaleidoscopic dance album that revels in the freedoms of living messily. The British singer does not have a golden voice, killer choreography, or a Grammy, but she is indelibly cool. And her coolness is not just a pose, it is true taste, a hankering for the very specific melodies, phrases, and beats that rouse her. In brattiness, Charlie, and that's spelled C-H-A-R-L-I, unlocks her inner paranoiac, mean girl, and so much more, a palette that further enlivens the restless electronic music she has long championed. The richness of the Brat persona and the immediacy of the songwriting turned the album into a zeitgeist event, but that massive success is secondary to the world's idiosyncratic purview. Brat, B-R-A-T, offers a 360 view of the scenes, experiences, and sounds that Charlie holds dear. So stylish. Number 6, My Method Actor. Nilufer, or Nilufer, N-I-L-U-F-E-R, Yanya, Y-A-N-Y-A. If Nilufer Yanya decided to put down her guitar and pursue a career as a vocalist, most of her fans probably would not protest. She's got a voice of velvet, rich, full, colorful. But the British singer-songwriter is also an accomplished strummer. And she spends her third album proving how essential the instrument is to her angsty songs of young love and adulthood. co-written entirely with electronic producer Will Archer, My Method Actor does more with less, finding strength in restrained melodies and subdued vocals that heighten the tension of her songwriting. 7. Absolute Elsewhere, Blood Incantation. Blood Incantation's third album is technically two songs divided into three tracks each. But good luck holding any number in your head as these arrangements blast you through space-time. The Denver death metal quartet rip through drone, prog rock, and ambient across the dense, riveting album, which is perpetually in transition. Technically, the music is about the obliteration of human consciousness upon coming into contact with an alien text. And that zany premise is the appeal. Moments of stillness build into the lysergic riffs, which beget gnarlier riffs before simmering into a synth-driven calm that gathers energy for the next detonation. For Blood Incantation, the metal mandate to seek extremity is joyously open-ended, freeing them to explore quietude as often as ruckus into the Stargate. 8. Please Don't Cry, Rhapsody. Rhapsody is spelled R-A-P-S-O-D-Y. Rhapsody is one of rap's premier lyricists, but on her fourth album, she flexes new muscles. Inspired by her idol, Lauryn Hill, the North Carolina rapper emphasizes expression over wit. Reflecting on her life and career over rich blends of R&B, soul, and reggae, she's an accomplished storyteller and spends much of the album, which is framed as a poignant therapy session, unspooling experiences as mundane as vacationing and as charged as watching a beloved relative lose their memory. It is her best music yet, and her pen remains potent. While her snappy lyrics structure these songs of reflection and self-care, her deep arsenal of flows, intonations, and melodies bring them to life. 9. Night Rain, R-E-I-G-N, A Rouge Aftab. Night ripples with possibility and wonder on composer and singer A Rouge Aftab's fourth solo album. A technician of texture and negative space, Aftab crafts gorgeous arrangements where soft tones and harmonies sound intense, despite the calm of the music. Influenced by a childhood spent between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, a formal musical education at Berklee College of Music, and a young adulthood in New York, she pulls from many traditions. The songwriting spans classical Hindustani and Western music, with lyrics from Aftab as well as an 18th century poem and a jazz standard. Aftab's not exactly a classicist, though. Her eclectic compositions, one of which features a very modern dose of auto-tune, evoke film noir, trip-hop, and Love Deluxe Arasada. For Aftab, night is a melting pot. Malagria, Reina Tropical. Okay, Malagria, the artist is spelled M-A-L-E-G-R-I-A, Reina, R-E-Y-N-A, Tropical, T-R-O-P-I-C-A-L. One of the founding members of this Los Angeles-based Latin act did not live to see the release of its debut album. Nectali Sumo Diaz, who formed the duo with guitarist and surviving member Fabiola Reina in 2016, died in an accident in 2022. The music nonetheless feels warm and triumphant. Reina, backed by a few producers, leads a humid romp through the dance cultures of the Latin diaspora, melding bouncy polyrhythms, syrupy melodies, and field recordings of birds and moving water. The album title is a Spanish word for bad happiness, a reference to both the sad circumstances of the album's creation and the broader coexistence of joy and pain. This is music for dancing away the grief and lingering inside it. And finally, the last page of the December 30, 2024 edition of Time Podcasts by Eliana Doctorman. Another 10 here, favorites of Time. Hysterical. The most engrossing podcast Dan Taberski has produced since Missing Richard Simmons, Hysterical, investigates a mysterious illness that spread among high school girls in Leroy, New York, beginning in 2011, in what is believed to be the largest case of mass hysteria since the Salem witch trials. The scandal occurred near Taberski's hometown, and he's able to bring a local charm to his color commentary and interviews, keeping what could be a dour show relatively light. Number 2, The Lonely Island and Seth Meyers Podcast. Celebrities' recaps of their own shows tend to be self-indulgent and not especially analytical. This is an exception. Seth Meyers teases insightful and hilarious stories out of his former Saturday Night Live co-workers, Andy Samberg, Jorma Taccone, and Akiva Schaffer, about the process of writing joke songs about, say, the kind of presents not normally wrapped in boxes. The podcast lands at an existential moment for SNL on the eve of its 50th anniversary. Some 20 years ago, The Lonely Island dragged SNL into the YouTube era. Perhaps there are lessons to be gleaned from this throwback show about the future of comedy. Number 3, The Wonder of Stevie. Guess what that's going to be about? Pulitzer Prize-winning cultural critic Wesley Morris tackles the career of iconic musician Stevie Wonder. With a little help from guests Barack and Michelle Obama. The show begins in 1972 and traces the next half decade in the musician's career, during which he won 12 Grammys. Morris is able to succinctly divine meaning from Wonder's art in this joyful celebration of an icon. Number 4, Hyperfixed. That's one word. Reply All alum Alex Goldman is back with a help desk style podcast. Goldman bills himself as an overconfident idiot who tries to find solutions to listener problems. Episodes unfold in unexpected ways. One in which he tries to teach a woman to drive evolves into a reflection on his own experience in an accident. It's a charming and addictive show. Empire City is number 5. Two words. This podcast about the history of the NYPD begins with audio from a disturbing video shot by the police surveilling host Shenjere Kumanyika's father, a civil rights activist. Kumanyika interweaves personal narrative with rigorous research on the history of policing in New York, beginning with officers earning payments by kidnapping free black men and women in the city and shipping them south to be enslaved, to demonstrate how trust eroded between the police and the people they are sworn to protect. Number 6, Modern Love. The long-running podcast, based on the popular New York Times column, experimented with a new format for its 20th anniversary. Host Anna Martin asked famous guests to read essays and then spoke with them about their chosen work's amorous themes. It is rare to hear guarded people open up, but something about narrating love stories preps these celebs for honesty, none more so than Andrew Garfield, a heart-on-his-sleeve actor whose viral episode brought many to tears. Number 7, 99% Invisible, The Power Broker. The preeminent podcast on design celebrated the 50th anniversary of Robert Caro's Pulitzer Prize winning Robert Moses biography, The Power Broker, with a book club. Hosts Roman Mars and Elliot Kellen invite guests like columnist Jamel Bowie and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to talk about the legacy of the city planner, who had a greater impact on the trajectory of New York City than anyone else in history. Number 8, my so-called midlife. Midlife is often marked by crisis, and host Reshma Sojani feels ready to blow up her monotonous existence as she stares down 50. On this show, she brings an almost pleading vulnerability to conversations with accomplished women like Emmy winner Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who offer life tips and guidance on finding happiness. 9, Things Fell Apart. John Ronson chronicles the culture wars by connecting the dots between isolated incidents and larger movements. Each episode asks a question like, how does a chance encounter at a yacht club between a sick girl's parents and a bartender spark COVID vaccine conspiracy theories? The listener comes away with a greater understanding of why we have lost a shared notion of truth. And finally, number 10, finally, this is really the title, a show about women. Finally, a show about women. In each episode, a different woman in a fascinating circumstance records a day in her normal life. They include an 80-something pinup girl shopping for vibrators and a telehealth abortion provider who works for the Satanic Temple. The show celebrates women, whatever their specific experiences may be. Our next edition of Time is moving further backward in time. From May 13, 2024, Time in this edition reviews 100 Health, the most influential doctors, scientists, and more. So 100 Health. In the wake of the pandemic, a new era emerges, marked by fresh discoveries, novel treatments, and global victories over disease. These are the most influential people in health in 2024. And again, this was written in May of 2024. Pioneers. Jens Juul Holst, Joel Hobner, Svetlana Moyshov, perhaps, M-O-J-S-O-V, and Dan Drucker. Paving the Way for Weight Loss Drugs by Dan Drucker. Oh, excuse me. No, this is a quote by Dan Drucker. If GLP-1 drugs show benefit for even half these conditions, then that will be a tremendous win for people struggling with them. Alice Park writes this and subsequent articles. Remember, this is Times 100 Health. Newly powerful weight loss drugs became the biggest story in health in the past year, and Jens Juul Holst, Joel Hobner, Svetlana Moyshov, and Dan Drucker played pivotal roles in making those medications possible. The scientists conducted the early work, beginning in the 1970s, on glucagon-like peptides, or GLPs, that first transformed the treatment of diabetes, and now that of obesity. As with many groundbreaking medical developments, it was a group effort. Holst, at the University of Copenhagen, noticed that after intestinal surgery, patients' levels of insulin soared, while their blood sugar levels dropped. He attributed the changes to several gut-related hormones, including glucagon. I'm spelling that G-L-U-C-A-G-O-N because I may be not pronouncing it correctly, which is made in the pancreas, the glucagon. Around the same time, an ocean and a continent away in Boston, Hobner and Drucker worked with animals in the lab at Massachusetts General Hospital and identified new types of glucagon hormones that they called GLP-1 and GLP-2. Moisov, a chemist two floors away, also independently identified the active portion of GLP-1, which is mimicked in the new weight loss drugs as the key compound in Ozempic and Wegovy, made by Novo Nordisk, and one of two main compounds in Mounjaro and Zepbound, made by Eli Lilly. Moisov produced large amounts of the peptide and developed antibodies to stick to them. The trio eventually collaborated on critical scientific papers that described the active part of GLP-1 in the guts of rats and documented that increasing GLP-1 levels corresponded to increasing levels of insulin. Decades later, that understanding led to today's revolution in diabetes and obesity treatments, which appear to be only the beginning for GLP-1-based medicines. The drugs have been approved to reduce the risk of heart disease, and researchers are studying them as potential therapies for kidney and liver disease, brain conditions like Alzheimer's, and many more. I do not pretend that GLP medicines will work for every single condition for which they're being studied, says Drucker, now at the University of Toronto. But if they show benefit for even half these conditions, then that will be a tremendous win for people struggling with them. Tulio de Oliveira. Again, these next more compact articles are all written by Alice Park. Hunting Viruses in Africa and Beyond. Tulio de Oliveira was the first to sequence the beta and Omicron variants of COVID-19, and he has not slowed down since, founding two scientific institutes in South Africa to train the next generation of genetic sleuths. This year, his groups joined forces with the UK's Wellcome Sanger Institute, the world's leader in genomic sequencing. The institutes will expand the monitoring network De Oliveira started in Africa to create a more robust international system of disease trackers. We have to think about pathogens as not just a national problem, but as a global problem, he says. Katsuhiko Hayashi, Defying Biology. First name Katsuhiko, last name Hayashi. Your biology teacher may have told you female mammals produce eggs, males make sperm, and the two combine to create an embryo. Katsuhiko Hayashi, a biology professor at Osaka University, turned that tenet on its head last year when he found a way to reprogram a male mouse's cells to develop into eggs. Those eggs were then fertilized with sperm and led to healthy baby mice. Sometimes I feel a little guilty, Hayashi says, because what I did was break the general rule of sexual reproduction. The research is too early to use in humans, and society will have to grapple with the ethical questions it raises, but it could one day help with infertility or even the breeding of endangered species. Barney Graham, laying a foundation. Respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, sends 3.6 million babies globally to the hospital each year. But until 2023, there was no effective vaccine to protect against it. That breakthrough came thanks to Barney Graham's work decades ago as a virologist at the National Institutes of Health's Vaccine Research Center, where he identified the form that RSV assumes just before it infects cells. He spent years finding a way to stabilize it. But COVID-19 hit before he could test it. Undeterred, he realized he could adapt his ideas to a new cause. The rest is vaccine history. Graham's work led to the first mRNA vaccines against COVID-19, and in 2023, to the first vaccine against RSV. Amy Kirby, finding data everywhere. Most of us prefer not to think about the waste we flush down the toilet, but environmental microbiologist Amy Kirby has turned it into a powerful scientific tool. When COVID-19 hit, she proposed taking a grant she had received to look for bacteria in wastewater and using it to look for SARS-CoV-2 instead. The result was the National Wastewater Surveillance System, which now includes 1,500 sites across the U.S. It's become a key way for health officials to monitor COVID-19 spikes and has already been expanded to detect influenza, RSV, and Mpox. Here's a short item by Tara Law. Jocelyn Block and Gregoire Courtine, Restoring Severed Links. After a motorbike accident damaged Gert-Jan Oskam's spine, he lost his ability to walk. Jocelyn Block, a neurosurgeon at Lausanne University Hospital in Switzerland, helped restore it by implanting several devices on his spine and, in 2023, in his brain, to build a digital bridge between the legs and the brain, she says. Oskam can now ascend stairs with a walker. Neuroscientist Gregoire Courtine, who helped lead the technology's development, hopes to make it available to the wider public in the next decade. Turning the page to more articles by various authors. Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, Orkin, O-R-K-I-N, taking aim at sickle cell. In December, the FDA, now remember this would have been December 2023, the FDA approved the first CRISPR-based treatment for sickle cell anemia. It is based on Stuart Orkin's career-long study of the hemoglobin gene, which is mutated in people with the disease. The procedure can essentially be a cure for many, but it is costly, invasive, and out of reach for most of the 20 million people with sickle cell disease worldwide. Orkin is not satisfied with those barriers. The question now is, what is the next iteration of this therapy, he says. And that article was by Alice Park. Another by Alice Park, Jerry Mendell, M-E-N-D-E-L-L, intervening early. In the 1960s, Jerry Mendell saw his first patient with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. More than half a century later, he developed the first treatment that holds back the disease. People with Duchenne are born with a mutation in the dystrophin gene, which makes a protein that's essential for healthy muscle. Symptoms typically begin early in life and get worse, leading to breathing problems, heart issues, and the loss of muscle control. While using gene therapy to replace the abnormal gene is the best solution, finding a way to deliver a healthy copy of it was difficult. Mendell studied a related muscle disorder in which people with slightly different mutations in dystrophin were able to maintain normal muscle, then teamed up with Sarepta Therapeutics to find a way to deliver the critical, healthy parts of that gene to patients with Duchenne, ultimately coming up with the gene therapy the FDA approved in June 2023. The first young boys treated with the therapy have not experienced the disease's major symptoms. We are not done by any means with perfecting the gene therapy, says Mendell. This is the opening event. Alice Park wrote that, and Tara Law has written the next short article, Adrian Hill, Targeting Malaria. For Adrian Hill, the stakes for a malaria vaccine were laid bare when, as a young researcher, in 1988, he worked at a hospital in Gambia. Children were crammed two and three to a bed, dying in front of your eyes. The world has gained ground since then, but about 600,000 people died from malaria in 2022, most younger than five. This year may mark a turning point. The first two vaccines are being rolled out, including R21 Matrix M, which was developed by Hill and collaborators and is 78% effective. Hill's vaccine is estimated to cost less than $4 a dose and has an annual manufacturing capacity for hundreds of millions of shots. If deployed widely, it could save hundreds of thousands of lives annually. Hill hopes the vaccine, in conjunction with medications and bed nets, will reawaken hopes of eradicating malaria, even within the next decade. This article will be, or will have been, written by Jamie Ducharme, Ziyad Al-Ali, Ziyad Al-Ali, advocating with research. Ziyad Al-Ali, a clinical epidemiologist at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, first read about long COVID, not in a medical journal, but in a patient advocate's op-ed. He's now published about 20 studies that have helped shape the world's understanding of the disease. Next up, focusing on treatments. These efforts are all guided by patients, Al-Ali says. People are asking us to do this work, and I feel a sense of responsibility. Turning the page now to another Alice Park, well, actually two more Alice Park articles, both short, and then one more that's even shorter. Catalin, K-A-T-A-L-I-N, Carrico, K-A-R-I-C-O, and Drew, D-R-E-W, Weissman, W-E-I-S-S-M-A-N, proving RNA's power. Their chance meeting in the 90s at the University of Pennsylvania, where Catalin Carrico and Drew Weissman both worked, changed history. The pair contributed to a brand new RNA-based approach to vaccines, which led to the development of the first mRNA vaccines for COVID-19. The shots earned Carrico and Weissman the 2023 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. We saw the potential of RNA, and neither of us would give up, says Weissman. Their next target, mRNA-focused treatments for cancer. Another Alice Park item here, Thomas Powles, P-O-W-L-E-S, maybe it's pronounced Powles, stretching cancer's clock. Most people with bladder cancer die within a year, a fact that Thomas Powles, a urologist at Queen Mary University of London, has tried to change for more than two decades. In 2023, he tested a new drug combination, a medication that enhances the immune system's attack on bladder cancer cells, plus an antibody targeted to those cells, and a chemotherapy agent. It more than doubled the median survival of patients to 2.5 years. It was beyond my expectations, he says. And another short Alice Park article, Georg Schett, G-E-O-R-G-S-C-H-E-T-T, autoimmunity breakthrough. The immune-based therapy, CAR-T, has dramatically improved outcomes for blood cancer patients. Scientists are also exploring its potential for autoimmune diseases like lupus. Schett and his colleagues performed the first CAR T treatments on 5 lupus patients in 2022, and 8 months later, all were in remission without needing immunosuppressive drugs. Last year, they published a second study showing another small group of patients were still in remission more than 2 years after CAR-T. David Baker, Designing the Future, this is by Will Henshaw. Baker has developed software that lets him design new proteins with cellular functions, opening up limitless opportunities, including horrifying ones like bioterrorism. In response to these fears, Baker shepherded an agreement this year, signed by more than 90 scientists in the field, that commits to promoting responsible research and use of AI protein creation tools. Kim Nolte, N-O-L-T-E, Caring for Asylum Seekers, by Sonia Mansour. In 2023, migrants arrived at the U.S. southern border in record numbers, often malnourished and ill. The Migrant Clinicians Network, based in Austin, offers those with urgent medical needs a lifeline. Kim Nolte, the group's CEO, says it helped more than 1,700 migrants access health care last year, triaging at shelters, scheduling appointments, following up with asylum seekers even as they move throughout their immigration journey. Health leaders next. This article by Jamie Ducharme. Bashar Murad, Care in War. B-A-S-H-A-R-M-U-R-A-D. Since the war between Israel and Hamas began in October 2023, Gaza's healthcare system has been severely damaged by Israeli airstrikes. As of early March, according to the International Rescue Committee, medical supplies were running scarce, and only a dozen of Gaza's 36 hospitals remained even partially functional. At a time when demand for medical services is off the charts because of the continuing conflict. In a November interview with Al Jazeera, local physician Bashar Murad described the situation as catastrophic, but that has not stopped him from doing whatever he can for the Palestinian people. Murad is the executive director of the Palestine Red Crescent Society, part of the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Movement, a global humanitarian network, which has stepped up to provide first aid, medical treatment, humanitarian aid, and psychosocial support as the Palestinian healthcare network was torn apart and international aid agencies were kept at bay. Under Murad's leadership, the Palestine Red Crescent Society performed emergency first aid on almost 18,000 injured people in the Gaza Strip from October 2023 to March 2024. In addition to providing community health care to more than 162,000 people and mental health support to almost 60,000, the group maintains a network of medical centers and relief camps where displaced people can also get food, water, and hygiene supplies throughout Gaza, and operates a fleet of ambulances that can respond to emergency situations. Although it has been forced to close or move some of its operations because of destruction in Gaza, the group continues to provide some of the most robust and sorely needed medical services currently available on the ground. From The View, World, Modifying India, by Michael Kugelman. This is a lengthy article that will probably be abridged. In April, two Indian writers published an ode to to their Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Titled Forever in Our Hearts, it recounts his achievements while singing his praises. Such gushing reverence captures the essence of Modi's popularity at home and among Indians abroad. But it also points to some darker developments in the world's largest democracy. Many Indians respect Modi, that's M-O-D-I. Others seem to worship him. He is beloved by a large majority of the country, as evidenced by an approval rating that climbed to a new high of 75% earlier in 2024. I should mention that this was written by Michael Kugelman. And Kugelman is director of the South Asia Institute at the Wilson Center. There is much that explains Modi's appeal. It includes his personality. Supporters see him as incorruptible. Leadership and communication styles and policy achievements, not to mention a weak opposition and the massive Bharatiya Janata Party machine behind him. That includes laws and policies that discriminate against Muslims, such as denying fast-track citizenship to Muslim refugees, restricting beef in some states, and expunging Muslim history from school textbooks. Modi has also been accused of hate speech, most recently in late April after a rally at which he referred to Muslims as infiltrators. Such rhetoric from the Prime Minister and other BJP leaders has been accompanied by rising attacks on religious minorities. This has all played out against a shrinking space for dissent, with crackdowns on media and broader civil society. Not all of this is unprecedented. Parts of India have long experienced religious tensions and deadly riots. There have also been periods during which Indian democracy struggled. That includes periodic states of emergency from 1975 to 1977, when the government, then led by the Congress Party's Indira Gandhi, stared down massive opposition protests with a heavy hand. But those cases were episodic. The assault on India's constitutionally enshrined secularism and resilient democracy today is playing out on a much greater scale. Still, while this Modification of India has not gone down well with many citizens, particularly Muslims, but also Sikhs and Christians, it has far too many backers to be characterized as a wholesale trampling on the public will. This may be the tyranny of the majority, but it is also something that enjoys a public mandate. For Modi and his mammoth base, this Hindu nationalist India is stronger, both domestically and internationally. It delivers big bang achievements from landing on the moon to becoming a top-performing economy. That may be why, despite pushback, including mass protests, Modi has rarely backed down on a new policy or law, and especially on religion-based issues. On the international stage, Modi's policies have also generated major criticism. Yet the West is reluctant to do anything about it. That's because it perceives India, owing to its size as well as military and economic clout, as a key partner in countering China. Much of the broader world sees India as a partner in these or other ways. There is therefore little choice but to accept the reality that India will be what Modi and many of his compatriots want it to be. For the West, this raises problems. Sure, there are positions India takes, like its embrace of multipolarity, which risks diluting U.S. power, and its enduring partnership with Russia, that have long annoyed Western capitals. New Delhi's crackdown on social media content risks scaring some away. The modification of India is not irreversible. The 73-year-old Modi will have to retire at some point, and a BJP deprived of its wildly popular leader may struggle to adjust. This may provide an opening for new BJP leaders with different ideas and policies. Other possible successors are more moderate than Interior Minister Amit Shah and Uttar Pradesh Chief Minister Yogi Adityanath. A change of BJP leadership could also provide an opening for a Congress party that has floundered since losing power in 2014. Nevertheless, for now, and certainly in the aftermath of elections, don't expect any modifications to India's Modification. There's a photo here. It's only about a quarter of a page, but it's in brilliant color. It's Modi waving to supporters in Ghaziabad, India. Mr. Modi is standing in, I think it's the immediate foreground of the bed of a truck. He's dressed in white with an orange cap. He has a gray-white beard, and he's surrounded by other individuals. They appear to be male. Some are wearing orange, some are wearing black. And this truck, which is what I think these people are riding in, is also orange, with lots of flowers, yellow, pink, and red flowers bedecking the roof of the truck, and streamers. Looks like silver and yellow streamers on either side of the cab of the truck. Several people are walking alongside the truck wearing dark, not uniforms, but dark shirts and trousers, dark sunglasses, and then in the background, large crowds of individuals on either side of this parade, I will call it. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.